Well, turning your Bible to Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2. I'm going to preach this morning out of this whole chapter. Still, it's not going to be a two-hour message. But I want you to be able to pick up on about four things throughout the chapter. The reason that I chose this chapter today is because this Sunday in the calendar is a special Sunday. You say, well, what makes it so special? It's just June the 9th. Well, it's special for a personal reason. Today's my wife's birthday. 39 and holding. When I married her, I married up. I've told people that for 41 years and soon to be 42. And I'm happy with my choice. If I didn't make but one good one in my life, that's been a good one. And so happy birthday. The second reason is because today is 7 weeks past Easter. What that means is, biblically, if you go back to the time of the Feast of the Passover, you have Jesus being crucified. During that time, if you were to go back to the Old Testament and read Leviticus chapter 23, you would find that it was also a time was what was called a wave offering or a sheaf offering. Basically, it was where people would go out into their fields and they would take some type of little small sickle and they would get a little handful of wheat. It had not been threshed, and they would bring it, and they would hold it, and they would wave it before the Lord. And that was an anticipation of the harvest that would be coming weeks later. 7 weeks have now passed, and you've got another feast that is about to take place. And just as they had taken that little sheaf and they had waved it, now when they come to the temple, they bring two loaves of bread. And those loaves of bread are to be offered at the temple. And that is the fruits, the first fruits of the crop that has come in. It was as though the first offering, the sheaf, was an offering of asking God to bless, and now this is an offering basically of thanks for the outpouring of God upon their crops. They had been blessed by the Lord, and so now they're 7 weeks past the Passover. 50 days. That's what the word Pentecost means. It means 50. And so here we are. We're 7 weeks beyond the resurrection. Jesus was the first fruits, and now we've got this feast. And what do we find in Acts chapter 2? What we find is we find an organization, we find an early group of believers, and we find the church. Now, I differ with a lot of people on when I think the church began. And I'm not going to hold it against you if you want to be wrong. If you want to hold to what the majority of people hold to. Most people think that the church was birthed in Acts chapter 2. I think that the church was empowered in Acts chapter 2. I think that Jesus organized the church in the Gospels. You say, now why do you think that? Well, because I believe in just reading the Bible literally. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, Jesus made this statement. He said, I will build my church. The word I will is future tense. I'm going to build it in the future. I have no problem with that. You go two chapters farther into chapter 18, and something else is said. Jesus said that if you have something against a brother, you go to that brother and you try to reconcile. But if he will not, you take somebody with you as a witness, and if he still will not, what do? You take him before the church. How can you take him before something that does not exist? That's just logic. And somebody would say, yeah, but the church really didn't get going until Acts 2. I'd agree with that. But if you want to believe like 99% of all Christianity, you can say that the church started in Acts chapter 2. But I think it began and was organized by Jesus when he was here walking around during his ministry during those three and a half years. So that's just a little Tommyology. Okay? Now, Acts chapter 2. I want you to see four things today. First thing that I want you to see is found in verse 1. In verse number 1, it says, "And when the day of Pentecost was fully come." That means that it had finally come to pass. It was fulfilled what was basically an anticipation. What was that anticipation? Well, the anticipation was the fact that Jesus had told them that they were to go to Jerusalem and they were to wait until they were endued with power. You say, where is that found? That's found in the first chapter of the book of Acts. You also find that it was prophesied way back over in the Old Testament about the Spirit being poured out upon people. And so I want you to hold your place here in the book of Acts, and I want you to go to the book of Joel. All right? The book of Joel, chapter number 2. And I want you to look with me, and if you can't get there, just make like you found it. Okay? All right? Look at verse number 28. "And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out my Spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my Spirit. And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. And the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. And the great and terrible the day of the Lord shall come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be delivered. And the Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance. As the Lord has said, in the remnant whom the Lord shall call." I believe that in Acts chapter 2 and also at the end times, this prophecy in Joel chapter 2 has been and will be fulfilled in its completion, in its totality, in the end times during the time of the tribulation. And so you have Acts chapter 2, and you have a partial fulfillment of the prophet Joel's prophetic utterance. And so you find in the day of Pentecost, 50 days, they're fully come. And what's happening? They were all with one accord in one place. So who do you have there? Well, you've got 120 people that are in an upper room. One of the greatest letdowns of a trip that I took to Israel was the trip to the upper room. If anybody ever wants you to take a trip to the upper room, pass on it. All right? You say, well, what happened? We walked about a mile to see buildings that had been built on the spot of the old upper room. It wasn't the upper room. It was simply the land that they think that it was on. And all I'm thinking is, I walked a mile for this. because that meant that I had to walk a mile back, all right? And in Jerusalem, the roads are this and that and crooked. You know, it's almost like you're doing the YMCA thing, all right? And so you've got this group of people that are in an upper room. Now, at one time, you had 500 people that saw Christ ascend into heaven. You find that over in the book of Corinthians, where Paul talked about he was seen of 500 at one time, the resurrected Lord. So now, what happened to the other 380? Well, probably what happened is they were visitors in Jerusalem at the time of the crucifixion and then the resurrection. And you have all of these people that had converged on Israel for the Passover, predominantly in Jerusalem for the Passover. I mean, that's where the temple was at. That's where all of the sacrifices would be offered. That's where all the gifts and the offerings would be taken. And so you've got all of these people that have come to Jerusalem, and all of a sudden Jesus is crucified. And then they hear rumblings 3 days later, he got up. And they begin to hear this. And all of a sudden you've got these people and they begin to go back, and maybe they've trusted Christ, these people that have seen the Lord. And so now you've only got 120 that are left. Maybe there was some of them that were Baptistic in the crowd. I heard a joke one time about some churches that were all in kind of one little area, and all three of them had bats in the attic. And so the preachers were talking. And so the Methodist preacher said, "Well, I'm telling you, I don't know what we're going to do." He said, "We've tried everything we can think of. I mean, we've even had people in there with guns. And matter of fact, one guy shot holes in the ceiling, and now we got to get the roof patched." Another guy said, "Well, I'm telling you, I don't know what we're going to do either." He said, "We've tried to be humane about it. We've tried to put all kind of traps up there, and we just can't get rid of them." And the Baptist preacher said, "Well, we didn't have no problem." He said, well, what did you do?" He said, "We just caught them all and baptized them, and we ain't seen them since." Well, I'm going to tell you, that's a lot of truth in that. We have people, and they make professions of faith, and we baptize them, and the FBI can't find them, all right? We got people on our roll, and somebody will go, "Have you seen so-and-so?" "Not in 4 years." And so you've got these people, and there's 120 now that are in the upper room, and they're just waiting. They're doing what the Lord had told them to do. And so you've got familiar people that are in this room. If you begin to take all the accounts together, you've got a little bit in Mark, you've got a little in Luke, you've got one in John, and you've got some in Acts. And who do you have there? You've got Mary Magdalene. She's there. You've got Mary, the mother of Jesus. She's there. You've got Susanna that's there. You've got Joanna that's there. You've got Cleophas and his wife. They're there. You've got probably Mary and Martha from Bethany. They're probably there. If Lazarus is still alive, most likely he's also there. You've also got the brothers of Jesus that are there. Now you say, "I thought they didn't believe." They didn't until after the resurrection. And then all of a sudden they realized that their older brother was the Son of God, and they put faith in him. If you doubt that, read the book of James and the book of Jude, because both of those men are the half-brothers of Jesus. And so then you've got the disciples that are there, and then it rounds out with people that we do not know. So there's 120 people, and you see that as they were there in one accord at one place in the upper room. And so the first thing that we see is we see the church just sitting and waiting. That's what we see. And so you and I need to simply wait on the Lord. But when God moves, that's when we move. And so we're just patient. We let God begin to work in our hearts. That was a beautiful song that was sung this morning about, "I'm just going to be still and let the Lord hear my heart." I thought about this as Tammy was singing. When my children were little, there were often times when they were 4 or 5 years old, I would be holding them and I maybe would be reading to them or telling them a story. And then I would say, all right, I want you to be real quiet. And I would take their head and I would pull their head over to my chest. And I said, what do you hear? They said, your heart. I said, that's right. And what is that saying? And after a while, they began to catch on. It's saying that your daddy loves you. I said, when you hear my heartbeat, you know that I love you. And so we get still and we let the Lord begin to speak to us. And there's a time for sitting. And this time for sitting was because Jesus had commanded them to sit. But there's a second thing I want you to see this morning. And that's found in verse number 2 through verse 13. Now, we're not going to read all of those verses. You can read those when you get home this afternoon or read them sometime before you go to bed tonight. But let me just comment on a couple of things. Look at verse number 2. And suddenly, in other words, it was not something that was long, drawn, dragged out. It says, suddenly there came a sound from heaven. In other words, it came from above. It did not come from below. As of a rushing mighty wind. All right? It did not say it was a rushing mighty wind. It says that it was as of a rushing mighty wind. That was the sound you were hearing. All of us have been in some type of storm when you have heard the winds howling. You've heard that. Well, just imagine if you're in a room, all of a sudden, it's not something that's on the outside of the building, it's in the room with you. That's the experience that they're seeing. And what happened? It filled the house where they were sitting. All right? And it says, and there appeared unto them cloven tongues. The word cloven, which simply means divided. You know, whenever I was a kid, they used to say in the Westerns, the Indians would say, you speak with a forked tongue. All right? Well, a cloven tongue is a divided tongue, right? And so there was a cloven tongue, not of fire, but like as fire. In other words, it was not going to burn them, but it was visible as a flame of a tongue that was divided. So you got fire going out both sides. So you're hearing the wind of like a huge storm, and all of a sudden you see cloven tongues of fire, and what is it doing? It begins to rest upon every one of the 120 people that are in this room. So imagine this morning if all of a sudden, and I say sudden intentionally, the wind began to make a sound through here, but we're not feeling it. But we're looking around and we're thinking, what's going on? And then all of a sudden we begin to look around, and I look over and coming down on Miss Melba, there's a fire that's divided. And I look over here and I see Miss Georgia, and there's a fire that's coming down, but that fire is divided. And all of a sudden I look around and there's 150, 175 fires that are coming down. I look up and all of a sudden there's one coming down on me. And it's something that is unique. This has never happened before. And can I tell you that it will never happen again like it happened in Acts chapter 2? There is no way that you can replicate Pentecost. Now, I know we've got some brethren and they'll say, we're going to have a Pentecostal Sunday. But can I tell you that you're really not? Just like Jesus was crucified one time and he was resurrected one time, there's only one Pentecost, and it happened in the book of Acts. Now, many of the things that are in our chapter and in the book of Acts can be replicated. But there's not going to be wind come through here unless it is artificially produced. There's not going to be cloven tongues like as fire that's going to come in here unless it is artificially produced. This was the Spirit of God that was being rested upon this church for the first time. Because you see, they had never been indwelt by the Spirit of God. This ushered in a new age. In the Old Testament, the Spirit of God was prevalent. If you read way back in Genesis chapter 1, the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep. The Spirit of God has been around as long as God the Father and God the Son has been around. If you read Genesis 1, it'll say, let man make us in our image. You've got the Trinity from the first time that we read about anything concerning God. But yet, you have this Spirit that is descending upon these folks, and you've got the Spirit of God that is going to now indwell people, unlike the Old Testament, when he would just come upon somebody. In the Old Testament, if you read through books like, say, the book of Judges, in the book of Judges, you'll read about a guy that we know of as a strong man named Samson. And in that book, you'll find it says this about Samson. It says that the Spirit of God came upon Samson. And when the Spirit of God came upon him, what does he do? He takes the jawbone of an ass and kills 1,000 Philistines. The Spirit of God comes upon him, and he goes over to the gates of a Philistine city called Gaza, and he lifts the gate post out of the ground and walks 2 miles up a hill with it and sets him up there and just laughs, basically, at the city because he carried their security off. The Spirit of God came upon him. You've got men like Isaiah and Jeremiah, and the Spirit of God comes upon them, and they write the Word of God. And so you had him come on, go off, come on, go off. Oh, but now, every person in this room that is a Christian, if you truly know Christ, the sweet Spirit of God indwells you, and the first time that that happened is in Acts chapter 2. Christians began to be indwelt by the Spirit of God in this chapter. And that's the way it is now 2,000 years later. People that get saved immediately become the temple of the Lord. And so they were one accord. That didn't mean they were in one Honda car. It means that they were all in unity, all right? They were all at one place. That means that the church ought to be together. We don't need to be scattered like lost jigsaw puzzle pieces. We need to all be together. We need to be unified in serving the Lord together. And so we see that the church is Spirit-filled. But there's a third thing that we see. The third thing is we see the church's first sermon. And that's found in verse 14 through verse 41. And the guy that's preaching this is a guy that is bad to put his foot in his mouth. Peter. Peter is always running his mouth and getting in trouble about something. You remember whenever he said, you know, Lord, you're not going to the cross. He said, I'll be willing to go with you both to prison and to death. And the Lord looked at him and said, you're going to deny me 3 times. And it's not but just a few hours later, and that's exactly what he has done. And I mean, he is always just running off the mouth, but all of a sudden, something's different about Peter. He's no longer quite the buffoon that he was before, right? Somehow, now, something has changed. What's changed? The Spirit of God has moved inside of him. And he begins to preach. And can I tell you, this first sermon was, you know, it wasn't all ushy-gushy and lovey-dovey, all right? I mean, he says some hard things. Who's listening to him? Well, it makes it outside of the upper room. And there's a crowd that's gathering because they know something's going on. And can I tell you that if something is happening in the church that's really of God, ultimately it's going to get into the community? And so you've got Peter now. He goes out and he begins to see the crowd, and the Spirit of God comes upon him, and he begins to preach the first sermon. Let's just take a couple of points that he preaches. What was the criticism? The criticism was these men were speaking in languages or dialects that nobody knew. What did they say? Bunch of Galileans. You know what that would mean if we were talking today?
bunch of hicks, bunch of hayseeds. Galileans were considered to be ignorant and unlearned people. And yet here they are, they're in this cosmopolitan city. You say, well, why would you say that they're cosmopolitan? Because they got people from all over the place. If you look at verse number 9, 10, and 11, you will find that there are 18 different groups from different places geographically that have converged upon Jerusalem for this feast. And all of these people are hearing in their own language. They're hearing even not just in their own language, but the Greek word is their own dialect. In other words, when people speak even with little nuances, you know, things like up in North Carolina, they don't say you all necessarily in North Carolina, they say Ewanses. All right? I mean, when I'm thinking Ewanses, had I not known what that was, I'd be thinking, what in the world is that? All right? You've got all kind of people. Let me ask you a question. Do you think you could take a South Georgia accent and not stand out in New York? I guarantee you could. Because somebody from New York, if they came down here, they'd say, you ain't from around here, are you? There's dialects. There's different. These people are hearing in their own dialects even. And they've got 18 different groups. I mean, from places from Egypt and Iran and places like that. And they have all converged. And now they're hearing the gospel preached. And you've got Peter preaching this first sermon, and he's just an ignorant Galilean. This guy never went to rabbinical school. He might have went when he was a little boy, but when he got older, he never had any formal education. That guy went to fishing. And now here he is, he's preaching, and boy, you talk about boldness. Look at verse 22. You men of Israel, hear the words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you. You've got him, and he's saying, you remember that Jesus that did all those miracles? You know God did that. And he said, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. And listen to this. He points his finger and says, you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain him. Now, I'm going to tell you something. That's pretty hard. But yet he had the boldness to preach the truth. Have you ever heard a preacher preach something hard and you think, oh, I just don't like that, but I need it? Have you ever heard anybody preach like that? I have. I've had people preach things and I'm thinking, I wish he'd have said something different. I wish he wouldn't have said that. But then all of a sudden you begin to think about it and it's like, but I'm guilty. And strong preaching is a good thing, folks. You ought not want to gravitate to somebody that never says anything negative. Because even a car battery's got to have a positive and a negative to start it. You need to find somebody that's willing to preach the truth regardless of who likes it or not. You know, we ought to have people that are willing to preach the gospel unadulterated. Not the gospel plus works, but just the gospel. What else did he tell them? Verse 36, therefore let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God hath made the same Jesus whom you've crucified, both Lord and God, or Lord and Christ. And when they heard it, they were pricked in their heart. When we have sermons to preach, it ought to be preached because there ought to be a change somewhere. Preaching and teaching that does not challenge people and convict people is useless. If we're going to preach, we ought to preach the Word of God that has the ability to change the hearts and lives of people. And he tells them, he said, you need to repent. I tell you what the old preachers used to say when I was a kid. They would say, turn or burn. That's pretty much what they would say. You either repent or you're going to go to hell. How many times have you heard anybody in the last 2 or 3 years preach on hell? Not a whole lot. You hear about it probably more here than you probably do most other places if you listen to preaching and teaching throughout the week. But everybody wants to talk about love, compassion, mercy, grace, and all of those are biblical topics. But can I tell you that for every sermon Jesus talked about love in heaven, he preached two on hell? And so we need to preach the whole counsel of God, not just pick and choose our little pets. And sometimes we preachers can get pets. I mean, sometimes we can. I mean, we can get off on this little hobby horse, and we can just preach on giving, or we can just preach on love, or we can preach on the second coming, or we can preach on this. And we just love our little hobby horses because that's what we're comfortable with. I mean, we just know it inside and out. It's like the old preacher that loved baptism. I probably have told you this maybe 8 or 10 years ago. It was the old preacher that loved baptism. And I mean, every week for about 7 weeks, he just preached on baptism. Every sermon, baptism. And finally, one of the deacons came to him and said, preacher, can you preach on something besides baptism? He said, I can preach on any subject in the Bible. He said, you choose it and I'll preach on it. He said, all right. So he told him, he said, I tell you what, why don't you preach on that passage that every tree that bringeth forth not good fruits, hewn down and cast into the fire. He said, I'll do it next Sunday. Next Sunday, he got up and he said, I'm preaching from the deacon's passage this morning. And the title is basically tearing down and cutting down trees. And after a few preliminary remarks about every tree that bringeth forth not good fruits hewn down and cast in the fire, he said, and bless God, why do you think they're cutting them trees down? They're cutting them trees down so they can get to the creek to have an old-fashioned baptism. Sometimes you just want to run those rabbits because you're comfortable with them. But as a preacher, you're supposed to preach the whole counsel of God and not your little pets. And so he preached this first sermon. Let me give you a fourth thing very quickly. Look at verse 42. In verse 42, it begins probably the most familiar portion of this chapter. It has the verses that we all love to read through. This early church, what did they do after that sermon? And all these people got saved and all these people got baptized. You say, well, how do you know they all got saved and baptized? Because our passage tells us that. It says, and they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine. They loved what the apostles were preaching. And so they continued listening and learning that doctrine, that teaching of the apostles. The early church was built upon the foundation of the apostles. And those early men, those 12 men. Now you remember, once Judas committed suicide, Matthias took his spot. Somebody says, well, I don't really think Matthias was legit. They say, I think the apostle Paul should have taken his spot. And I say, well, why would you say that? And you would probably respond, or somebody would respond, well, they were shooting dice to make that choice. Do you know that there's a verse over in Proverbs that says that even the casting of lots can be directed by God? And so I think that Matthias was a legitimate choice. And I think that the apostle Paul was an apostle called out of due time. But the 12, evidently there needed to be 12 of them. And so Judas is dead. Matthias is chosen. And they began to teach and preach, and that early church listened and adhered to and held on to that doctrine. And so they continued in fellowship. They just liked being around each other. Can I tell you that we ought to love being around one another? Do you know the whole reason that I moved the service on Sunday nights from 6 o'clock to 5 o'clock? So that after church, people could go have a cup of coffee together. So you could go eat you a basket of chips and dip together. So you go get you an ice cream together. That's the only reason. I mean, when we moved from 6 to 5, it cut into my nap. And I like Sunday afternoon naps. I don't even get to go home most Sundays anymore. And so it's for fellowship. We ought to just enjoy being around one another. We ought to enjoy going out to eat with one another. We ought to enjoy going over to each other's house. That just ought to be a normal day in the life of a Christian. Not only that, but they continued in breaking of bread. What's that? That's communion, the Lord's table. They used to love to do the Lord's table. Now, the scriptures do not tell us how often to do it. We do it 4 times a year here at the church. We did it last Sunday night. But we do it 4 times. That's just what we've decided upon. But some churches do it once a year. Some people do it every week. To me, if you do it every week, you know, it kind of gets routine. And I want it to be a special time because it ought to be a special time. And so they were breaking bread together and in prayers. And if you begin to read the rest of it, they loved each other. They had compassion on one another. You say, well, why do you think they had that? Well, let me ask you a question. If you had had a job and you had a boss, and your boss was anti-Christian, I mean, he or she just absolutely did not like Christians. And then you accept Christ and you begin to tell people, let me tell you what happened to me at church. I got saved. And then that boss comes to you and says, you know, I don't think we need you anymore. You say, do you think that would really happen? Absolutely it would happen. Absolutely it would happen. We've got people in this church, and I haven't heard about it recently, but we've had people in this church in the last 20 years, and their promotion stopped because they took a stand for Christ and would not go and get snockered at the office parties. They stopped right here at this level when vice president of certain areas could have been their next step, but because they had some people above them that were hostile toward Christianity, everything stopped and they retired at those levels. Now you go back to the book of Acts. What is that early church predominantly made up of? Jewish people. That was the main body of that early church. Now you had Gentiles that began to be a part of it. And by the time you get to, I think it's the Acts chapter 13, the whole central sending agency of the church had moved from Jerusalem to Antioch, which was Gentile. But Jerusalem was primarily Jewish. Now you think you're one of those 3,000 people. When did the Jews worship? Saturday. When do Christians worship? Sunday. What do the Jewish people do on Sunday? They work. And so here you are, you're an employee. Your boss is of a different faith. You can't work when they want to work. They don't like what you've been doing. They don't like that you have publicly baptized in the name of Christ. We don't need you anymore. And so it's no wonder that when you read in Acts chapter 2, it says that these people had things in common. Can I tell you that if I knew one of you this morning did not have food in your house, do you realize that this church would have you some food before the sun goes down tonight? We're not going to let one of our church family not have food. Now, you may not get a filet mignon. You might be getting some hamburger helper. But you're going to get something. Why? Because we love each other. We do for each other, just like that early church did.
It does not teach communism. People gave as they wanted to give. They gave out of their heart. They gave out of a love for the church. But there's nothing communistic about Christianity. And so you've got the church, and they are spreading. Well, if you look at the latter or last verse, the latter part of verse 47, what were these people doing? They were praising God, having favor with all the people that are in the church, and the Lord added to the church daily, as should be saved. These people were so excited about what had happened on the day of Pentecost that they just couldn't talk enough about it. On Wednesday, my mom went to the hospital in Statesboro. My sister spent Wednesday night there, and I drove down, and I got there about 9 o'clock on Thursday night, and I spent Thursday night sitting in a hospital chair trying to sleep. It don't work. We got her home the next day, and we were talking, and my mother, she made this statement. She said, you know, I just think sometimes I just talk too much. Because she is constantly asking questions. She'll ask the nurse, and she already knows the answer. She wants to see if the nurse knows the answer. What's that pill right there? Well, that's a... I don't know. I forgot the names of them. Ativan. What's that one right there? Well, that's for your blood pressure. What's that one right there? Well, that's a water pill. Well, my mom already knows that stuff. But she just wants to make sure that that girl knows it, or that guy, whoever the nurse is. And then she'll even talk to the doctors. And she'll say, you know, I probably just talk too much. Can I tell you that this early church, they just couldn't talk enough about Jesus. He had saved them, and they were happy about it. There is nothing greater that's ever happened in your life than when you met Christ. As wonderful as it has been, in all the years that I've been married, when my children were born, when I began at this church, all of those things have been fantastic days in my life. But none of them can compare to what's going to take place, the anniversary of it, on Tuesday. Because way back in 1972, back just after Noah got off the ark, according to the young people, that's the day that I got saved. And my life has never been the same. There have been ups and downs spiritually. But I'm going to tell you something. When the Spirit of God moved in, and when I yield myself to the Spirit of God, everything gets a whole lot better, a whole lot faster. I want us to have a church full of people. And even though the Spirit of God is not going to descend on us with cloven tongues of fire, and we're not going to hear rushing mighty wind inside of here, I can tell you that there will be a spirit that could blow through this congregation, and it would just be nothing but pure bliss and pure joy in all of our hearts. But it all comes down to this. Are we going to be a church that is willing to wait? Are we going to be a church that is willing to yield like that early 120 were, and let the Spirit of God move when He chooses to? And that's exactly what Jesus told Nicodemus in John chapter 3. He said, the wind bloweth where it listeth. In other words, the Spirit of God can move ever how He chooses to move. And God may move upon some of you to do something, and some of you to do something, and He may not move on some of you to do anything. But then again, He may move on the whole church for us to try to reach our community and try to see people be saved and have their lives changed. Pentecost. There'll never be another one like it
but we can take many of the lessons that were learned there and we can apply them to this church family. Let's stand together.